Hello, everyone. Well, today, the fine folks over on Patreon, and consider that the obligatory plug if you want to support the channel, go over to the Patreon link in the video description. That's my annual plug done for the day. Anyway, they asked for this month for me to review Drax's 5 most harebrained naval plans of all time. Now, one or two of these I may have covered in various other videos, sometimes in depth, sometimes just mentioning, but, well, since there are some really harebrained naval plans out there, these are my top 5 as of, well, quarter 2 2026. If you have others that you'd like me to review in detail or in another top 5 or something like that, obviously pop them down in the comments below. But I've selected these 5 specifically, not so much because they were completely and utterly disastrous in the long run, although many of them were, but that wasn't the main criteria. The main criteria that I've used to select these 5 is simply because there were so many obvious alternatives, and it was fairly obvious to anyone who stopped to think for more than 5 seconds that these really were not going to work or could have very, very significant unintended consequences going further. Because ultimately, you know, some naval plans do go terribly, but to be fair, looking at it from the perspective of the time, you couldn't necessarily have known that, or maybe there was a decent chance it might have gone okay and you rolled the dice and, well, it came up short. But anyway, let's get on with number 1. And for this, we go to the beginning of World War I, specifically the 3rd of November 1914. Now, at this point, the Ottomans had proven themselves rather a thorn in the side of the Triple Entente. They'd allowed Goeben and Breslau to escape into Ottoman custody and later theoretically joining the Ottoman Navy. And by the 3rd of November, the Ottoman Navy at Ottoman branch of the German Navy had launched a raid using Goeben and Breslau on the Russian Navy in the Black Sea. And so in the great 19th century imperial spirit of something must be done, oh yes, 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 imagine twitching a large handlebar moustache at this point, the Royal Navy and the Marine Nationale decided that they would do something. And that involved sending the battle cruisers Indomitable and Indefatigable, along with the French pre-dreadnoughts Suffren and Vérité, to go and shoot up the outer forts of the Dardanelles. Now, officially, this was classified as a testing of the defences. In practice, there was very little, apart from perhaps the scale of it, that was all that different from a 19th century, the uppity colonials have started rebelling against their betters, therefore we should blow some of them up with some of our ships, and that'll show them what for. Essentially, it was a 19th century colonial slap across the face, you know, knock it off, don't do it again, or else. And to be entirely fair, the bombardment went fairly well. The French took one side, the batteries at Kumkale, and the British took the other side, the batteries at Sed el Bahar. I think that's how it's pronounced, apologies if I got that a bit wrong. But in any case, they started shooting things up. Indefatigable and Indomitable both recorded that their first salvos were slightly to the left, but then they corrected and their second salvos landed pretty much dead on target. And you can tell that this was very much a colonial-style operation because they were even told going in exactly how many shells they were allowed to fire. It wasn't even a case of, we want to actually blow these things up. It was, you will go in, you will fire this many shells at the enemy forts, and then you will withdraw, with an extra caveat of, well, if the Ottoman gunners actually learn how to shoot straight, then you might want to withdraw slightly earlier, because while most of the Ottoman defences were fairly obsolete, they did have a few guns that were slightly worrying, especially if you were a battle cruiser with 4, 5, or 6 inch armor plate. And those included, ironically enough, some 11 inch Krupp guns that were very similar to the ones that would eventually do in Blücher several decades later over in Norway. As the bombardment went on, they found very quickly that at early accurate gunnery, with the second salvo from both battle cruisers landing on target, actually presented something of a problem because it threw up so much rock and brick dust immediately in front of and around the fort that it was very difficult to work out where the next shells were landing. They were just firing into the cloud and, well, hearing explosions and thinking, well, that cloud is where the target is. Clearly, we are still hitting things. And it turned out this was actually an accurate assessment because shortly thereafter, the main magazine at Sedd El Bahr was hit and there was a colossal explosion. Now, during all this time, the Ottoman gunners were actually firing back. Shockingly enough, you know, people don't tend to stand around under heavy artillery bombardment and do nothing. But being completely unprepared and mostly equipped with obsolete guns, their fire was relatively ineffective. Eventually, some of the gunners started getting a little bit more accurate, but the overall scope of the bombardment was very much in the Allies' favour. The French shot up Kumkale as much as they wanted to. They didn't manage to blow up a magazine. But the net result was that by the end of the bombardment, a significant damage had been done to both forts, obviously more to Sedd El Bahr, thanks to the magazine explosion. A lot of the Ottoman defenders had either fled or hidden, and a few of the braver ones were firing back. But if at that stage someone had thought to maybe bring some troops along, it would have been a relatively trivial process to march up to those forts and seize them. However, as we said, this was basically a colonial slap across the face operation, not a serious amphibious operation. And so having decided that, well, you know, Johnny a foreigner has been jolly well chastised, the Allies withdrew. Now, this was, of course, a catastrophically misguided operation because the Ottomans had, prior to 1914, been, while not 100% confident, relatively confident in the state of their Dardanelles defences. They'd been being advised by the Germans for a little while on this, but the Germans had taken one look at them and gone, we're not so sure about this. We think you should probably upgrade them a little. And the Ottomans said, no, we appreciate that feedback, but really, I think we've got enough guns and enough forts, we'll be okay. This operation rather proved that that was an optimistic assessment, to say the least, since they'd managed to score precisely zero hits on a relatively small ad hoc Allied force, and had one of their forts half exploded and the other one Swiss cheesed. And the Ottomans and their German advisers, not being stupid, looked at it and went, yeah, if they'd landed and taken those forts, we really would have been stuffed. And also, the rest of the fortifications going up the Dardanelles aren't in tremendously better condition, and a number of them are in significantly worse condition. We don't have any mines in the actual water. So if this had been a serious operation, we could very well have lost the Dardanelles as a whole, or a good chunk of it. We should probably do something about that. And the Germans, in between mutterings of, yes, we have been telling you this for many years now, went, ah, brilliant, fantastic, they're actually going to listen to us. And, of course, there were a bunch of sailors and artillery experts who'd recently arrived on Koben and Breslau to help as well. And over the next few months, bear in mind this was the beginning of November, over the next few months, the defences of the Dardanelles were significantly improved. Fortifications were reinforced, new guns were put in place, existing guns were maintained and refitted, mines were prepared for deployment, etc., etc. And so that meant that in February 1915, having convinced themselves from the results of the November bombardment that the Ottoman defences were pretty much an easy pushover, the Allies showed up with a nice big fleet of mostly pre-dreadnoughts intending to just blow their way through the Dardanelles, sail up to the Ottoman capital, and demand their surrender. Only to find, as I covered in a relatively extensive video some years ago, that the reinforced defences were a much tougher nut to crack, which ended up costing them a lot of ships, despite bringing a lot more firepower to bear than they had in the November 1914 bombardment. And when that failed, then it was time for mass troop landings, and that, of course, all spiralled into the debacle that was Gallipoli. So, while it's not necessarily possible to say 100% that the Gallipoli operation would have been considerably more successful and allowed the Allied fleet through to Constantinople-Istanbul if this operation hadn't been done, given the relative lack of defences and lack of preparedness in the Ottoman fortifications in November 1914 compared to February 1915, it certainly would have been far more likely that the what we now call Dardanelles campaign and Gallipoli operations would have been considerably more successful and possibly fully successful if the Ottomans had sat back for those intervening 3 or 4 months, perfectly happy and convinced that their defences were actually workable. So in terms of harebrained naval schemes, this one really has to take the cake, because literally all it did was inform your opponent of where you were going to come, what you were going to do, and what all the weaknesses were that you needed to correct in your defences before they showed up, before then leaving them several months to make said improvements. So in an attempt to treat the Ottomans like they were just some 19th century colony, the Allies, and this operation, yes, was directed at the behest of Winston Churchill, who, as I said many times before, brilliant leader in the overall strategy terms, do not let him near anything tactical, managed to end up probably costing tens of thousands of Allied lives. And for number two, we're going to stick with the Royal Navy, but we're going to advance the clock a little bit forward to the end of World War II and look at the post-World War II British carrier fleet plans. Because, oh boy, was this a hot mess. So as we get to the end of 1945, Britain is in a situation that is much like that in the US Navy. The majority of their pre-war carrier fleet did not survive. Hermes had been sunk, Eagle had been sunk, Courageous, Glorious, Ark Royal, all sunk. Of their pre-war carrier fleet, i.e. ships laid down and commissioned prior to the 3rd of September 1939, the sole survivors were HMS Furious and HMS Argus, much as in the US, they had Enterprise, Saratoga, and Ranger, having lost Hornet, Yorktown, Lexington, and Wasp. Now, to be fair, nobody was particularly trying to retain poor old Argus and Furious. They were very quickly moved into reserve and then scrapped before the decade was out. But that left the Royal Navy with a combination of wartime build ships, ships they'd tried to build during wartime, and some of them weren't quite complete yet, and ships that they had been planning to build. So they had HMS Unicorn, the honestly not an aircraft carrier gov. They had the four Illustrious class, all of which had been heavily used during the war. They had the two newer, larger, and far less battered Implacable class. And then they had a whole run of 1942 design light fleet carriers, the Colossuses and the Majestics, some of which had just about been commissioned, others were in the process of commissioning or under the process of construction. In terms of ships that had been built during the war, at least laid down during the war, but nowhere near actually close to commissioning, they had the Audacious class, they had the Centaur class, and in theory, they had the Malta class, although by the end of World War II, they were currently under suspension. Plus, of course, there were a bunch of escort carriers around, but as I covered in the escort carrier video, the escort carriers weren't very long for this world in terms of active service. So broadly speaking, you can divide this into three groups, as we just mentioned. You've got war-built ships that have been used during the war, you've got ships that are brand new, just coming off the slipways, and you've got ships currently under construction, but will need quite a while before they're actually ready to come into the Navy. Now, of course, the Royal Navy is facing significant downsizing in the post-World War II environment, and it also has the issue of carrier aircraft becoming bigger, heavier, and, of course, with the advent of jet aircraft, faster, but the advent of jet aircraft means that there are different challenges with regards to takeoff and recovery, because of the different power performance of jet engines compared to propeller engines on takeoff and landing. So logically speaking, you would take a look at your carrier fleet and decide, okay, we should keep the carriers that are best suited for future operations, so able to take big, heavy aircraft with high hangars to fit said heavy aircraft and can be fitted relatively easily or refitted with technology as it progresses, things like the newly under development steam catapults. And given that we have steam catapults, angled flight decks, and all sorts of other things currently under either consideration, development, or testing, maybe we should wait and see how all this works out and incorporate this into the design of a carrier or carrier class that's under construction at the moment that is perhaps, I don't know, very early in its stages of development, and therefore we can afford to make changes to the design without massively altering what's already being built. Now, of course, this would all make sense. However, thanks to Treasury and government pressure, in part, the Royal Navy ends up doing pretty much the exact opposite of what it really should do. So let's go through each of the three groups of carriers one by one. First, the war-build carriers that had actually seen service, the Illustrious and the Implacables. We're going to let Unicorn slide because Unicorn was a very useful aircraft maintenance vessel. And, okay, yeah, she looks like a carrier, she acts like a carrier, but, okay, we're going to say she's technically not a carrier, let her be. Now, I'm aware there is an article up on NavWeps that also, you know, significantly lays into the British post-war carrier program and the armoured carriers in particular. However, while I agree with the general gist of the idea that they weren't particularly useful post-war, that particular article is riddled with so many errors, it's kind of an anomaly on the website. It is actually a pretty terrible article, all things told. So, don't think I'm referencing that because, well, the only reason I would reference that would be what didn't happen and what wasn't the case. Anyway, the Illustrious class had, to varying degrees, been fairly heavily battered by the Luftwaffe, the Regia Aeronautica, and the Imperial Japanese Navy's air arm during World War II. There was a fair amount of damage that had been made good for the most part. Other damage needed a fairly extensive refit, and that refit would also include things like machinery, depending on the vessel in question, because these vessels, while they were only 5 or 6 years old in 1945-1946, had been very heavily used. Typically speaking, a warship at this time would go for about 20 years or so before needing a machinery refit, but heavy use in wartime tended to put a 3 to 5 times multiplier on the machinery wear and tear. And so actually, the class as a whole probably only had 3 to 5 years of machinery life left at normal peacetime levels of operation. And in addition to that, they'd been built with 1930s aircraft in mind, plus with reduced hangar heights due to their armoured flight decks. And so they just flat out couldn't fit a good chunk of the up-and-coming carrier aircraft that were under development at the time, particularly jets. Also, having been built under naval treaty restrictions, the Illustriouses had a fairly small air group. They had managed to significantly improve that in the Pacific by using deck parking, but it was still somewhat restricted compared to the Implacable class, which were also armoured flight deck carriers, but they were considerably larger, could support considerably more aircraft, had a lot more machinery life left on them because, well, they'd only commissioned in 1944, so they had run for a relatively limited time during the Second World War. And while their hangar height was also fairly restricted, there were only 2 of them compared to 4 Illustriouses, and there were sketched out plans at that stage which demonstrated that if you did take them in for a refit in, say, the early 1950s, you could combine the 2 hangars into 1 much larger hangar, which would still have a fairly respectable air group and would be able to accommodate aircraft of any realistic size. So clearly the thing to do with these 2 classes of carriers would be to use the Illustrious class as test vessels and training ships and refit the Implacables as the fleet carriers. Now, whilst all of the ships, with the exception of Formidable, which was too badly worn and damaged to be of much use and was quickly decommissioned and scrapped, the Royal Navy did the opposite of that. While Implacable and Indefatigable did spend a brief period of time in the fleet, their post-war career consisted almost entirely of being refitted into training ships and serving as training ships, while the 3 surviving Illustrious class, although, as I said, they did do a degree of experimental work, were used as the primary fleet carriers, despite being smaller, more battered, and less capable. And then, to cap it all off, they decided to try and refit Victorious, which is a whole video in and of itself, the epic disaster that led to. And since Victorious ate all the budget for refits, Implacable and Indefatigable ended up being scrapped without any kind of significant modernizations. So they ended up essentially spending a whole ton of money on characters that they knew weren't very long for this world and couldn't do all that much anyway. And that moves us on to the second group, the 1942 Light Fleet carriers, the Colossus and Majestic classes. Now, these vessels admittedly were a little bit slow compared to the full fleet carriers. They could only do about 25 knots. But thanks to not being armoured carriers, they were almost as large as the Illustriouses, displaced considerably less, and could carry considerably more aircraft in hangars that were considerably higher. So as long as you weren't looking for full-speed fleet operations, a Colossus class was actually a much better post-World War II aircraft platform than an Illustrious in almost every respect. And let's face it, the Soviets didn't exactly have a high-speed battle fleet that was going to come chasing you. And they were pretty much brand new. They were all coming into service for the most part in 1945 with a handful that were still under fitting out. And then there was the Majestic class, which were also under construction and could be finished relatively quickly if they wanted to. And the Majestics were slightly evolved versions of the Colossuses that were even more capable of supporting modern aircraft. So again, logically speaking, if you were concerned about carriage of number of aircraft, being able to have hulls in multiple places, being able to have hulls that would endure for a fairly long period because they're brand new, it would actually make sense to get rid of the Illustriouses very quickly. And, okay, yes, Britain needs money. Maybe you want to sell some carriers on. Maybe sell on the Colossuses because they are this slightly less capable of the two 1942 designs. And keep the Majestics, because even with the Majestics that were actually built, let alone the ones that were cancelled, there were still six of them on the stocks, plus loads and loads of Colossuses. So you could replace four Illustriouses, three realistically given Formidable's condition, with six Majestics, which would give you cheaper hulls to operate, bigger hangars, more aircraft capacity, and being unarmoured, it would also be a very easy job to modify them going forward, given the various systems that were under development, as we've already discussed. So what did the Royal Navy do? The Majestics were mostly left on the stocks, took ages to commission, and were all sold to other navies pretty much as soon as they came into service. They did retain a few of the Colossuses, the less capable ones, and sold a bunch of them on to various other navies as well, all the while trying to vaguely and bravely pretend that the Illustriouses still had a good future. And that leaves us with the ships that were definitely still under construction, so the Audaciouses, the Centaurs, and the Maltas. Now, again, logically, what would you do? Perhaps use some of your cheap, lightly built 1942 fleet carriers, maybe some of the Colossuses you don't manage to sell, as experimental ships to test all these new systems. And then given that the Maltas are the least under construction, but also have the most capability going forwards, as they are the largest, then those ships can be completely redesigned essentially on the stocks, and you can build brand new carriers, perhaps in the 1950s when there's a bit more money available, and these will be essentially, if you imagine the midway refits of the mid-Cold War period, something approximately similar to that. Now, you already do have the Centaurs and some of the Audaciouses on the stocks, and the Audaciouses are obviously more capable still even than the Implacables, and the Centaurs, likewise, are far more capable than the Majestics. But the problem is, if you build the Maltas, the Audaciouses, and the Centaurs and try to have them all in service at once, you'll have three separate types of hull in service, assuming that you don't still have any of the previous hulls still in service. And bear in mind, at this stage, most of the Centaurs either hadn't been laid down at all or had barely had any work done to them. A couple of them had some work done. Eagle and Ark Royal, or the ships that would eventually become Eagle and Ark Royal, had somewhat more substantial work done to them. That's the two Audaciouses, and there were, technically speaking, two more supposed to be on the books, one of which was actually, again, partway under construction. So, once more, logically, you would suspend all the work on the Maltas and the Centaurs and use them as essentially a high-low mix, the Maltas being the big ones, the Centaurs being somewhat smaller supporting vessels, but all designed to operate modern aircraft and take into account all the lessons that you're learning from operating and modifying and testing all your previous carriers. What to do with the Audaciouses is a little bit more difficult because they do need to be constructed and launched fairly soon, if for no other reason than to free up the slipway spaces. But given that they would be of an intermediate step between the Implacables and the Maltas, it would be logical to perhaps launch them and complete them relatively quickly, get them into service, which would allow you to then make a choice of either keeping them in service to replace the Implacables without doing an extensive refit of their hangars, or operate them alongside the Implacables for a while, which would give you four large fleet carriers at the very minimum, assuming you didn't also complete the third Audacious. And that would give you a decent core of a post-war carrier fleet while you were waiting for the Maltas to come along. And then once the Maltas did come along, you could then make a decision of, are we going to keep the Audaciouses and the Implacables around long-term as secondary vessels? Are we going to turn them into helicopter support ships? Or are we just going to get rid of them or maybe even sell them on, considering the Royal Navy was doing a bit of a fire sale with aircraft carriers in the late 1940s? So collectively, what does the logical course of action add up to? Well, pretty much put the Illustriouses into reserve dash scrap immediately, keep the Implacables around, sell off the Colossuses to raise money, keep the Majestics around, use the Majestics as your test bed, possibly with one or two unsold Colossuses as well, and use all of that to influence redesigns for the Centaurs and Maltas, which you can hold off on building until lessons are learned, and then in the early 1950s, when you have a bit more money, then you can build the Centaurs and the Maltas as your brand new Cold War fleet with angled flight decks, steam turbines, catapults, etc., etc., etc. And the Audaciouses are really about the only thing that are going to be a little bit of an intricate question to solve. And what does the Royal Navy do instead? They cancel the Maltas. They hold Eagle and Ark Royal in abeyance, which leads to all sorts of problems going forward because, well, a half-completed ship gets all sorts of water infiltration and interesting issues. They sell off all the Majestics. They keep a few of the less capable Colossuses around and sell off most of those as well. And as we said, they turn Implacable and Indefatigable into training ships, try to refit the Illustriouses, fail abysmally at that, and end up wasting vast amounts of money, which results in, by the end of the 1950s, a much, much reduced and much less capable Royal Navy carrier fleet. About the only real success story to come out of the entire debacle was the fact that despite all the abuse heaped on them while they were under construction, Eagle and Ark Royal proved somewhat useful to the Royal Navy during most of the Cold War, and the Centaurs in particular proved to be outstanding vessels, hanging around for a very, very long time, HMS Hermes in particular, of course, serving as the biggest Royal Navy carrier present during the Falklands War, and then sold to the Indians, and she actually made it into the 21st century. So, yeah, compared to something that someone could have come up with in half a day sitting down and plotting out a logical course, which would have saved money and given the Royal Navy a far more capable carrier fleet going into the Cold War, the Royal Navy, admittedly with a lot of pressure from the Treasury, ended up doing pretty much the direct opposite and suffered duly for it. So having given the Royal Navy a bit of a drubbing for the last two choices, choice number three would be the German naval build-up pre-World War I. This was a particularly disastrous and harebrained idea that essentially was based around a fundamental misunderstanding of what sea power means, something that was quite common with a lot of navies when they read about Mahan's doctrine, but also specifically when it comes to Germany's relationship with Britain. You see, at the start of the 20th century, Britain and Germany were actually fairly close. Britain's traditional enemies were France and Russia, and, well, although Germany hadn't been around for all that long as a continuous unified country, Germany's natural enemies were also France and Russia. So in the general British trend of finding an ally to keep one power from becoming a general European hegemon, Germany seemed to be a good choice because it was situated between France and Russia. It would stop them being able to unite and combine their forces. And since Germany generally didn't want to fight a two-front war, it was unlikely that Germany would try and dominate the entirety of Europe because if they fought one, they'd have to then be attacked from the rear by the other. And since Britain didn't have a particularly large army, they weren't exactly going to be helping out in a ground campaign, although they could help out at sea. But a combination of Kaiser Wilhelm II and Alfred von Tirpitz decided that Germany should have its own big colonial empire, what they termed its place in the sun. Now, in the late 19th and early 20th century, no one particularly objected to this idea in principle. The idea of European powers each having a nice big colonial empire that they could show off was pretty much accepted, if not expected, of various powers. However, the Germans decided to approach this from a perspective of wanting to become either the number one or at least a very close number two to Britain, partly because Wilhelm was very envious of Britain. But even with Germany's rapidly burgeoning industrial sector, one thing was very clear, very quickly. Germany did not have the shipbuilding infrastructure to outbuild the British. And on top of that, because Germany was a continental European power, it needed to have a large and powerful army because, well, other nations around it had large and powerful armies as well. And that meant that even if German industry could exceed British industry in terms of total output, a lot of that industrial output, both in terms of actual manufactured goods and money generated, would have to go into the army. So a smaller budget would always be available for the Navy. And from that was derived the risk fleet theory. And this was the idea that if Germany had a fleet that was large enough, not as large as the British, but large enough that if the British fought it, it would massively diminish the Royal Navy's strength, then although the Royal Navy would be technically capable of defeating them, the British wouldn't want to try because in so doing, they would weaken the Royal Navy to a point where other navies, which at that point were massively behind the Royal Navy, would then be large enough to pose a significant threat and perhaps take advantage themselves. So, for example, if the German fleet was 60% the size of the Royal Navy, even if the Royal Navy only lost 40% of its strength fighting and destroying the German fleet, it would leave the Royal Navy at about the same size as the German fleet had been, at which point, for example, the French and Russian fleets combined might stand a chance of destroying it. And obviously, if the German fleet was larger, the Royal Navy would lose more ships fighting it, which would make France, Russia, the US, etc., even more likely to jump in and opportunistically finish off what remained. And thus the reasoning went, if the Royal Navy didn't want to fight the German fleet, the alternative would be to either let the Germans do whatever they wanted, or at the very least to come to some kind of accommodation, which was at least broadly in favour of Germany. But the reason this was a fairly harebrained naval scheme was twofold. Firstly, it relied, as so many naval plans seem to do, both real ones and hypothetical ones that people put forward, on the opposition, in this case the British, just doing what they were already doing and not changing in the slightest. So what happened as the Germans started to build up their fleet is that Britain went, oh, a threat. Okay, well, I guess we'll start building more ships, which of course meant the Germans had to build even more ships to keep up, and the British had a bigger and more efficient shipbuilding industry, so they started to rapidly pull ahead, and then of course Jackie Fisher went, also Dreadnought. And that kind of kickstarted the Dreadnought arms race. But as it turned out, the British were capable of building vastly more warships and also building them considerably quicker than the Germans could. And so the Germans ended up in a spiraling arms race they physically couldn't win, which ended up drawing up a huge amount of money from their army, which wasn't very happy about it, that fact. And when the army finally put their foot down and said, no, we want some of our funding, and the British just kept on building ships for a while because they didn't quite get the message that the Germans had kind of thrown the towel in, the British ended up with a fleet that actually put them even further up the superiority list compared to everybody else's navies than they had been before, at which point the entire point of the risk fleet went out the window because the risk fleet was still much smaller than the British. But now, even if Tirpitz's idea had come true and the British had fought the Germans and lost a proportion of their fleet and then ended up with everybody else turning on them, the remnant of the Royal Navy that would have been left would still have been big enough and mean enough to fight any realistic challenger. And of course, the British could continue to churn out even bigger and more powerful ships. So yeah, the first error was not realizing the British would just crank up their own shipbuilding volumes. And the second problem was a far more geopolitical one, and that was simply a failure to understand what a navy meant. To the Germans, a navy was a tool of power. It was a way of asserting their dominance or their position in the grand scheme of things. And for most people, this is what a navy was. For the British Empire, however, a navy was an existential issue. For a small island nation with a massive overseas empire, if Britain didn't have command of the seas, the empire would die sooner or later, either because people would cut off portions of that empire and start taking it for themselves, and there wouldn't be anything the Royal Navy could do about it if the other side had a bigger fleet, or at least a bigger concentration of ships in the local area that the Royal Navy couldn't match. Or, in a longer-term issue, if the Royal Navy couldn't maintain its dominance over the global sea lanes, then it was very likely that the British dominance of merchant trade, which was funding the British Empire in large part, would start to slip away. And if that slipped away, then, well, along with the prestige and the revenue involved, you would also start to lose the various trade links, because it's very easy, if you control two-thirds of the world shipping, to say, hey, you need to either trade exclusively with us, colonies, or you need to trade favorably with us. And if you trade with other people, then there are going to be tariff barriers and so forth. But if, because you've lost command and control of the seas, you then lose the position as the world's most dominant merchant carrier, then other merchant carriers and their nations can offer better and more favorable rates. So at that point, you neither are now trading at parity, or perhaps even they are trading more or more favorably with other nations. And so the downward spiral of empire would continue. And so if Britain wanted to maintain its empire, it had to have a big navy. And that meant that not only were they going to invest a lot of money in it anyway, but if someone appeared to challenge that navy, they would throw pretty much everything and the kitchen sink at keeping their dominance at basically all costs up until they physically ran out of money. And well, at the beginning of the 20th century, if there was one nation that wasn't going to run out of money before everyone else, it was going to be the British Empire. Now, eventually, two world wars did manage to drain Britain of all of its money, but I would point out that Britain managed to be on the winning side in both world wars, and also was the only nation that fought both world wars to victory from the very start to the very finish, which, you know, yeah, that probably will drain the coffers of a world-spanning empire, even so. And so Germany's risk fleet plan was only ever guaranteed to force the British to build an even larger navy and force them to be hostile to the Germans, because the Germans were now posing an existential threat to the British Empire, and it was a race the Germans were never going to win. And instead it just resulted in a very, very destructive world war. Which, of course, the British Empire did survive and the German Empire did not. And then we move slightly westward to France, and somewhat back in time, because everything we've been looking at so far has been World War I, World War II. Now we're going back to the Age of Sail, and I'm just going to collectively put the French attempts to invade Ireland in as a single entry. Now, I've discussed in the past why it's very difficult for a French fleet, or indeed any fleet, to get into the Channel, but the French especially, and getting into the Channel is kind of necessary if you want to invade England. But during the various conflicts between Britain and France in the 1700s and 1800s, the various French officials had this brilliant idea of, well, why don't we invade Ireland instead? Because bear in mind, at that point, Ireland was part of the United Kingdom. Now it's the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland, but of course, the Republic of Ireland only became independent at the beginning of the 20th century. And so it was technically British soil, much as the locals may have wanted to disagree with that. And the thinking was that, well, the Irish, generally speaking, weren't great fans of the British, which is still true in some quarters, and therefore they will be likely to rise up, particularly if the French are backing one of the Stuart kings. So Jacobite uprisings are very much a thing. And they were kind of held true with a few times the French actually managed to successfully get troops into Ireland. And the idea then was, okay, well, we take over Ireland with the assistance of some of the locals, and once we've taken over Ireland, then we can march over to the Irish Sea, or sail over the Irish Sea, to the UK, and take the rest of it. Well, there were two very, very, very big problems which make this a completely idiotic scheme. Firstly, some of the Irish didn't like the British. Others rather did. And plus, there were various British and Scots and Welsh settlers. And so what you ended up with, even in the most successful attempt, which ended up with the Battle of the Boyne and things like this, was a war in Ireland. At which point, well, Britain is a lot closer to Ireland than France is, so it's easier to supply a British army in the field in Ireland. Both sides have local support in various areas, but the British, thanks to in part just being there already, and thanks to the Irish habit of having semi-continuous uprisings, also had a pretty good idea about how to fight in Ireland. The French really didn't. And so even when they managed to get troops in, it ended in failure, and even if it ended otherwise, well, there aren't many large ports in Ireland, and you still would have had, you know, raids and hotbeds of dissent against the French and potential British counter-invasions and so forth. But even so, even assuming that Ireland was now somehow happily united under French rulership, you still would have faced exactly the same problem which most of the invasion attempts to Ireland faced, which was the weather between northwestern France and Ireland is pretty terrible most of the time. And also the Royal Navy and all of its bases are still in between. So if you do launch an invasion fleet and it does sail to Ireland, if the Royal Navy doesn't think that the weather is going to just smash up and disperse your fleet anyway, which it usually did, they can very easily sail ships out to intercept you. And if they don't intercept you on the way in, they can intercept you on the way back, so you won't be able to run supplies to your army in Ireland, so they'll wither on the vine pretty quickly. And of course, every time they intercept and capture some of your ships, well, the Royal Navy's gotten stronger, your Navy's gotten weaker, which means follow-up supply attempts and or follow-up invasion attempts are going to be at even less strength. And this is historically what happened. The French spent huge amounts of money, huge amounts of time, and huge amounts of men and ships constantly trying to send invasions over to Ireland, and the vast majority of them ended up sunk or captured and put into British service, and it cost them a huge amount of money and a huge amount of troops, which was a net drain on the French economy generally, and specifically on the French war effort. The harebrained part is that they just kept doing it. Now, to be fair, even the French Navy eventually learned, and by the time you get to the Napoleonic Wars, various people are still floating the idea, and the French Navy, as the 1700s go on, starts to resist the idea more and more and more and more. But it is still tried occasionally. This is why you get the battle between Indefatigable and Amazon against the Douart de Lhomme being one of the last holdout survivors of the latest invasion attempt against Ireland. So in summary, it's something that is very unlikely to work, didn't historically work. They kept trying again and again and again, and it kept failing, and they kept trying. And even in the world's most optimistic scenario, where somehow it does work and they end up in control of Ireland, well, they now have a very similar problem to the problem they originally had. They've still got to get a fleet to England, and the Royal Navy is going to be sitting there going, I don't think so. Except now you have a massive supply problem to deal with as well. And then finally, in our list of most harebrained naval plans of all time, we're going to head still further west, all the way across the Atlantic, to the United States. And specifically, we're going to look at the first couple of decades of the United States as a country, because the United States had initially formed during the American War of Independence with a navy, the Continental Navy. Admittedly, it was a little bit of a slapdash job. Few purpose-built warships, a lot of repurposed vessels, and I do need to do a video on the Continental Navy at some point. But broadly speaking, the United States did have a navy, and indeed this is kind of why the United States Navy itself justifies its existence as technically being older than the country, because the Continental Navy was formed before the United States actually itself formed, or was internationally recognized at the very least. But in the years subsequent to that, the US Congress and various US politicians took a view that the United States didn't need a navy at all. On land, through a mixture of political ideology and, to be fair, propaganda that was already beginning to embed itself and has embedded itself in popular American culture very much even to this day, they'd gotten into their head that citizen militias were somehow an effective fighting force on their own and would suffice to be the sole defense of the United States. Well, the War of 1812 kind of showed how that particular paradigm worked out in various places like the Battles of Bladensburg, but nonetheless, at sea, the same decision was taken. They wanted to cut costs, so they decided to get rid of a navy on the broad justification that the United States wasn't going to get involved in any wars overseas, and as such only needed to worry about home defense, and for home defense they could rely on citizen militias, which would consist of small rowing boats with single 24 or 32 pounder cannon on them, which weren't even purpose designed to hold cannon, they were just general inshore craft, which would be called up in a time of need to form a little gunboat squadron, which would presumably go and see off the attackers. The reason this counts as a harebrained naval plan is, well, there's lots and lots and lots of reasons, but a few of the highlights include the idea of small single gun or two, three gun equipped gunboats fighting larger navies had been tried repeatedly at this point in history, and it had never worked. Because if the enemy showed up with any substantial naval force, and let's face it, if anyone was coming to attack the continental United States, they had to have a navy that was capable of projecting power across the Atlantic, so it was going to be a fairly substantial naval force. Well, the minute there's any kind of rough weather that can, you know, I don't know, swamp a boat that has a 1 foot freeboard, yeah, the big navy is going to be there, and you aren't. If the wind is particularly decent, the big navy can outsail you. And yes, you can row up to them in periods of calm, but at that point you are still an open-topped boat armed with a single cannon, or maybe a handful of them, and the ship that you're attacking has lots of cannons and can use its anchors and lines to maneuver itself around and shoot you with a lot of canister shot and one hit with a decent round shot and your boat is going under. And of course, if the Navy decides that maybe for whatever reason going up a river or into an estuary full of angry colonists crawling around with tiny boats armed with guns is not to their liking, well, they can just up sticks and move. And they can either go to another area, but if they don't want to go to a completely different town or city, which may, to be fair, have its own little sea militia, they can just go 10 miles up the coast if they want to land troops, and they're going to get there a heck of a lot faster than you are. Plus, of course, there's the fact that these small little rowboat militias don't have any kind of significant staying power. Yeah, you can row out, but you don't have any real supplies, so you can row out for the day, maybe stay out overnight if you're feeling particularly ambitious, and then you have to go back again. A big sailing ship that's just spent weeks, if not months, coming across the Atlantic, it can afford to wait a couple of days for you to get bored and go home, and then continue its operations. And so, even based on historical precedent, it was very clear that this was never going to work. They just decided it was going to work because ideological reasons. And then, of course, you had the other problem, which was that in the late 1700s, the United States depended very, very heavily on international trade. It was not the kind of self-sufficient economy that it would later become. Now, of course, even in the early 20th century, the United States still needed international trade to be as powerful as it was, but by that point, even if the United States had been fully cut off by a blockade, it could survive on its internal economy and industry. In the late 1700s and early 1800s, this was very much not the case. If you didn't want the entire country to go into complete economic meltdown, you needed to maintain the trade routes. And, well, how do you maintain those trade routes? Well, you have friendly relations with everybody, unfortunately. the single largest naval power on the planet was the Royal Navy, and understandably, in the aftermath of the War of Independence, they weren't particularly happy with the Americans, so the Royal Navy wasn't going to be protecting American merchant ships anytime soon. And, then the Americans decided we are going to try and trade with everybody in the middle of a massive global conflict. And then the French decided that they didn't like this either. There's a whole bunch of other reasons for the quasi-war, but short summary. So America ended up out of sorts with the Royal Navy, in a minor war with the French Navy, and then the Barbary pirates turned around and went, oh, undefended merchant ships that nobody else likes. Money, 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 free money for me. And then it became very clear that even if your delusions about a citizen militia of little boats armed with single cannons was true, there was exactly nothing they could do to protect American merchantmen on the high seas because, you ain't persuading a citizen militia to row all the way across the Atlantic to fight Algerian corsairs in the Mediterranean. And so in the 1790s, the Americans changed tune pretty quickly and started building an actual fleet. You know, the whole Navy thing that 2 decades ago they'd been saying they didn't need. So yeah, that was one particularly harebrained idea. It turns out if your entire economic lifeline depends on international trade, you do in fact need a navy. Lessons that a few countries perhaps these days could also take into account, but there you go. And there you have it. In just over 50 minutes, I've outlined what I consider to be 5 of the most harebrained naval plans of all time and why. But as I said, if you have other ideas that you want to have a look at and have me discuss, let me know in the comments below and see you in again in another video. Bye for now.
That's it for this video. Thanks for watching. If you have a comment or suggestion for a ship to review, let us know in the comments below. Don't forget to comment on the pinned post for dry dock questions.